Thanks for having me, man.
It's my pleasure. How much time do you have? I just want to make sure I control the tangents.
An hour cool?
An hour is cool. That's time for tangents.
Very good.
I like that.
That's my specialty.
I love it. Mine too. Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is January 22nd. My guest today, one of the most requested in the history of our operation here, comedian Dave Smith. I presented Dave with a two-question outline. And man, I'm happy we didn't stick to it. We packed a lot into a single hour. So many unexpected twists and turns. Hey, in fact, why don't you take a moment and try to guess what the time code is when we start talking about 9/11 truth? Go ahead and write it down on a piece of paper, put it in an envelope, and send it to me. The person who gets closest to the correct time code will receive a School Sucks sticker in the mail. That's a lot of work for a sticker, Brett. If you're new to Dave Smith and you like what you hear today, he has two podcasts. One is a comedy show called Legion of Skanks. The other is his more politically focused show that is called Part of the Problem. Dave is, in my opinion, one of the most energetic and effective advocates for the philosophy of liberty on the scene today. I definitely look forward to opportunities to work with him more in the future. I'm sure Dave would also really appreciate it if you all went and followed him on Twitter at @ComicDaveSmith. And while you have your phone in your hand, I don't really do much on Twitter, but I do have an Instagram. And if you follow me there, your life will get a little better. It is just an absolute cavalcade of delights, pictures, and vids. And yesterday I was doing some SEO research, and I was looking at sites that link to SSP and, like, you know, sources of lots of traffic. And I found that we are linked on the University of Alberta's. This is like a top five Canadian university, basically making it like the Abbott of Canada. On their page for academic integrity, they have a link to our website, schoolsucksproject.com. So you could go to Instagram and see that. Put a little heart next to it. Leave a comment. I'll put a heart next to your comment. Other than that, if you are interested in learning more and getting updates about the encore presentation of the Ideas into Action Summit coming up relatively soon, this was a very positively reviewed event that we did at the end of last year, so much so that I've decided to do the same event again with a few new enhancements. Just go to SSPUniversity.com. Around here, we like to remind people that you can just spell that university, SSPUniversity.com, to learn more. Okay, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dave Smith and all of the wonderful twists and turns that it takes. If anybody can produce like a graphical map of this conversation and send it to me, what's better than a sticker? I don't know. I'll come paint your house, okay? All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Here we go. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show for the very first time the great Dave Smith.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of the show. And be careful the way you use that word great. I've gotten in trouble for this recently.
Tell me about it.
I called Stefan Molyneux great.
I heard this. Yeah. And you got called out on the fake libertarian page for it.
That's right. Now I was like, it's maybe just my weird contrarian personality, but I'm like, who else can I call great that would piss them off?
Right. So speaking of that, our worlds have certainly overlapped in lots of places, but this is the very first time we've ever talked. So I appreciate you coming on the show. And when two guys are talking for the first time, a thing that I think is really nice, I'd like to tell you some things about you that I really enjoy, if that's all
right. Oh, sure. That's my favorite thing. We could make that the whole episode.
So first time I ever heard of you was actually, it wasn't that long ago. It might have been like 2017. And you were sitting in for Gavin McGinnis on his show. And you did these two back-to-back interviews that I thought were absolutely amazing. And I listened to them and I'm like, this is what the world needs right now. They weren't the best characters, but they were the people that you wanted to talk to. Do you remember what I'm speaking of?
I sure do. I've gotten an endless amount of crap over that that show. But yeah, I Gavin McGinnis, who's a good friend of mine. Actually, I haven't spoken to him in quite a while, but I love Gavin. And he asked me to guest host his show. And it was, there had just been this video that went viral where Richard Spencer had shown up to a libertarian event of some sort. I can't remember what it was. And Jeffrey Tucker and a bunch of other libertarians basically denounced him and screamed fascist at him and told him to get out. And they I think ended up kicking him out of this group, or maybe they couldn't because they were at a restaurant and they couldn't actually kick him out.
Right.
And so my first thought, I knew he had been on the show before. So my first thought was, okay, well, let me talk to him. And then Christopher Cantwell and me, this is before Christopher Cantwell got like famous, you know, from the Charlottesville thing.
Yeah.
But he had been calling me out online. So I was like, well, why don't I just do this? Why don't we make it a show where, since Gavin was kind of considered like an alt-right character and I'm like a hardcore libertarian, I'll have these two alt-right guys on. And instead of just screaming fascist at them, actually ask them what their views are and try to have a conversation. Seemed reasonable to me.
Yeah. And it made a real impact on me, you know, because they were uncomfortable but powerful conversations. And I think at that time, I think it took a lot of courage to do that. So those were my first two memories of Dave Smith. I talked to Cantwell, I think I was on his show like the end of 2015. And man, we didn't agree on much, but it was one of the best conversations that I ever had, that I ever put in my podcast feed. For sure.
Yeah. Well, I saw this dynamic around that year. So this must have been 2016 or early 2017. And I saw this, and I hate when people make a big deal out of, you know, the libertarian to alt-right pipeline. I don't know how much of that is real or not. I mean, people move in and out of radical political views, and there's certainly a pipeline from, you know, I don't know, from socialism to the alt-right. And there's all types of pipelines. But there's no question there was, like, the alt-right had a tremendous amount of energy. And there were several libertarians who went in that direction. And I just felt like it's so weird from the perspective of a radical libertarian, like a Rothbardian like myself, who is used to people refusing to grapple with your ideas and just call you names to then be doing the same thing to some other group. And I was like, if we don't kind of try to talk to these people, we are going to lose and they're going to get all the energy. And I'm coming at this from a perspective of, I don't want to see this movement, you know, take off. So I kind of felt like it was necessary. And also I just don't quite, you know, and I think you have some of this too, where I kind of reject the whole moral paradigm that's given to us that we all have to accept, where I can go on a Fox News show and I've done panels with John Bolton before, and no libertarian ever accused me of being too chummy with him or for having a conversation with a bad guy.
Right.
But then I'm supposed to reject Christopher Cantwell because he's just beyond the pale of terribleness. And I don't buy that. I think there's, you know, racism is not a great thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know that it's the worst thing in the world. It's certainly not as bad as advocating, you know, genocide in a third world country.
Well, here's part of the impact that it had for me. It was kind of like this turning point moment at a time where, you know, I was in New Hampshire then. I was a Free Stater, so I was part of that scene for, you know, the better part of a decade. And after a while, you know, there's no shortage of thinkers there. But an echo chamber does develop. And there were some things that, you know, people kind of conveniently decided on, like, this is a bad guy. We don't talk to this guy. We don't entertain these ideas. Really, maybe just as the function of a movement that had some kind of like political aim in it. So to hear somebody identify as a libertarian and then say, nope, these are the people that I want to talk to, right? Not like we're building a bridge or a pipeline here, but to have that conversation, I thought was really important. Not much of that since then, but from anybody going anyway. But the other one was a couple of debates I was really impressed with. Obviously, we all waited for what happened at the Soho Forum with Nicholas Sarwark. I thought that was great. And you were on this show. This was probably a couple of years ago with Sam Cedar, Majority Report, it's called.
Mm.
And I reached out to Sam maybe in like 2012, and, you know, I always liked him. He's a progressive, if people haven't heard of him, but nice guy, funny guy, thoughtful guy, considering like where he wound up ideologically, ultimately. But he said, I don't want to talk to you about philosophy. I'm tired of talking to libertarians about philosophy. I'll talk to you about politics. And so our conversation never actually happened, but he was a guy who did like to do this routine where he would have libertarian callers on his show and basically just make them eat shit for however long they were on the phone, right?
Yeah.
So then he says, I'm gonna have a debate with Walter Block. And somehow he makes Walter Block eat shit for the entire debate. So when I saw you, I thought that was like the best example of any exchange he ever had with a libertarian. And it was like, I was hopeful. It seemed like he actually got something out of that conversation.
So. Yeah, well, that one, I wasn't really happy with the way that that one went. And it was like the first time I ever did anything like that. I was a little bit green, I think, at the time. And he's a tricky guy. He's difficult to tangle with. And there were just like listening back to that one for me is painful. There's just a lot of, oh, I should have said this type moments.
Always. Yeah.
But that was my take. But I also, you know, he did in that conversation with me at a certain point was, you know, like, well, okay, I don't really want to talk about the philosophy anymore, you know, same type deal. And he did make some claims that were really kind of bonkers to me, even from the progressive point of view. He was like, well, if you don't like the system, you can leave at one point and things like that. It was an interesting experience. I'd like to tangle with him again.
I think you should, because I think those kinds of like those arguments with progressives or people on the left or even, you know, certain people on the right, they kind of become these lost moments in time, right? Where those people have that experience where they go, oh, geez, I don't really know what to do from here. Okay, I'll concede that. And then they sort of retreat to their comfort zones and reinforce their ideas. And then it's basically Groundhog Day. You've probably had these conversations in your personal life where, you know, you go back to somebody a week later and you say, well, what happened? I thought we made progress at dinner last Sunday. And you're right back to where we started. It's a super frustrating thing. So, I would love to see that again. And I think he's a pretty good interlocutor.
I agree.
Yeah. There was a good forum for that. So also, when two guys are getting to know each other, I know this from being a Free Stater, there's always at least one of the topics of conversation is how did you get here, right? And I've heard you tell certain parts of this story in other interviews, but... I listened to a lot of these conversations in New Hampshire through my time in the FSP. I was always surprised how absent schooling was from people's pipeline to liberty. Like, not a lot of people talked about schooling. While this is probably the most sustained and for most people who never go to jail or never have to fight in a war, the most counter-individual liberty experience that they have in their entire lives.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes on for 15,000 hours, you know? But I found it absent in a lot of the, like, journeys to libertarianism stories. So I wanted to kind of open today with, is it a part of your story? What was it like for you?
Well, there's nothing about my, you know, my experience with school is completely separate from pretty much all of my experiences with education. I got almost nothing out of school. I mean, I don't want to over exaggerate. I mean, I learned how to read and, you know, there were like basic things that I learned, you know, as a young kid in school, but all of every inch of, you know, philosophy that I believe in, economics and anything like that, history, foreign policy, all of that I learned after I dropped out of college. I would say that there was one, like, I think I had two profound libertarian experiences as a child, but I don't think they really, you know, like I didn't really fully think them through or appreciate them. But one would be that I did, and actually Murray Rothbard wrote about having this this same experience, but I did go to both public and private school. And I think that there was something about that that maybe lingered in the back of my mind where it's, you know, I had a lot of problems with the private school, didn't love it, but man, was it better than the public option. I mean, the public school I went to was just a nightmare. And I went to like a particularly bad public school. It was probably ranked decent at the time, the 90s in Brooklyn. But it was just, you know, fist fights and violence, threats of violence from teachers, actual violence from teachers. I mean, there's, you know, it's really funny when you hear like, you know, Democratic politicians or something, the way they talk about public school teachers, it's like they're all heroes and these really wonderful people who just work so hard and should be making more money. And I'll tell you, from going to PS 107 in Brooklyn, New York for first, second, and third grade, there were maybe like two or three people in the whole school who met that definition. And then there were the entire rest of the school was either people who were just lazy government workers, didn't care at all, or straight up people who were borderline criminal and should never be allowed around children. I mean, like I said, threats of violence, actual violence, just horrific stuff.
Do you know about the rubber rooms? Have you ever heard that term?
Yeah, right. That's where they can't fire these teachers. So they just pay them to go sit in a room somewhere, right?
And play board games. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Pay some of them six figures.
It's still a lot better than them being around children, as frustrating as that is.
That's true. So you said you dropped out of college. Why did you go to college and why did you leave college?
I went to college because that was, you know, the thing to do after high school.
I've heard people say this. Yeah.
You'd be crazy if you didn't do it. And that was like, you're ruining your whole life. I remember, you know, the college counselor at my high school telling, you know, repeating this notion that this was the most important decision you were ever going to make, which I just, of all the lies to tell an 18-year-old, that the idea that any decision you make at 18 is the most important decision you're ever going to make in your life. I've made 7 decisions today that were more important than to college. Just deciding what outfit I was going to dress my daughter in was probably more important. So it was just like a lot of pressure to do it. And I really felt like, well, you'd be a failure if you didn't go to college. So I went, to Hartwick College in upstate New York in Oneonta. And I made it a year and a half, 3 semesters up there. And I hated it. I hated every inch of it. Not the one of the things that really stuck out to me immediately there was that it was really dumb. And I mean, like the other students, the classes, there was nothing interesting. It was like, you know, you were going there with like 90, like this was a school that pretty much anyone could get into. It wasn't like a really good school.
Sure.
And so there was very few people there who were actually intellectually curious or anything like that. It was a stop off to go drink beer and maybe be on a sports team or be in some club after high school. And I just hated it. I got nothing out of it.
What did you want to get out of it? Or did you totally feel like you were just riding the rails of college counseling into that place? Because, I mean, I felt like that was my experience, that it was the 13th grade.
I think that was my mentality as well. But I guess on some level, I was like, you know, still kind of believed in some abstract way, well, this is higher learning and you're supposed to be, you know, kind of getting something out of this. Like it's a given that this is education. And I remember being very turned off by just the fact that nothing was interesting, nothing interested me. And also there were a few of the professors. I mean, this was back in, I guess like 2003, 2004. So this was, you know, it's college campus craziness wasn't exactly what it is today. But there were some professors there who were just these ridiculous leftists, like really absurd. And I remember right away thinking like, this is not right. I remember having this one history professor who was all this like radical egalitarian to the point of just absurdity. I remember him making these arguments that he said the only difference between men and women was completely environmental, that there was no genetic difference between men and women. And I remember getting in questioning him and being like, well, what do you mean no genetic difference? And this, I've never thought these things through before, but I was like, well, obviously there are genetic differences between men and women. Like this is basic genetics. And he was like, well, besides, you know, genitalia, there's nothing else. And I was like, so you think if our environment lent itself, you know, in a different way that women could play in the NFL and be, you know, like Ray Lewis could just tackle some female quarterback and there wouldn't be a problem with that? And he said it was straight face, said absolutely, absolutely. It's all about how we raise our daughters. So basically we could raise them to convince them that they could be Ray Lewis. There's no genetic component to this whatsoever. I remember right away just thinking like, this is just so dumb. Like anybody should be able to be, and you're a college professor talking about this. And it, so I just kind of hung out there, and I didn't like it. I didn't like the city of Oneonta. I'm a New York City guy. It was like boring and lonely. Mm-hmm. And then I just left.
Where were you politically at that time? Like, you're recognizing these things, but I've also heard you say that you came from the left, right?
Yeah. Well, I was never like a hard ideological lefty. I was like a liberal Democrat, I guess. You know, that was just kind of what was in my mind. I mean, I was, you know, I'm a Jewish kid from Brooklyn. I was raised by a single mother. I smoked a lot of weed in high school, and I, you know, like, that was just the only option kind of in town. Mm-hmm. And things like, you know, like, obviously you should tax rich people a little bit more and give it to people who are poor. I mean, duh, they need the money more than the rich. Like, the only other answer would be that you're just like some cold-blooded, you know, horrible person who would rather a billionaire have his fifth yacht than some, you know, single mother have a little bit of help. So that is just these obvious things. Of course, we should raise the minimum wage because, you know, people have low wages. Let's give them higher wages. Just kind of this really very shallow surface level stuff. But I was never like a hardcore leftist ideologue.
Right.
The only time that I think I might have maybe flirted with right-wing neoconservative stuff was after 9/11. I was very like, let's go get these bastards. That I really got into that for a little bit. I was in New York when that happened. But then, as you know, as the Bush years grew on, I just kind of joined the crowd of being like, yeah, these wars are bad, and George W. Bush is a terrible president. It was very easy. You know, he was stupid. Everybody was, you know, the whole media and everyone in college and all that was against him. So it was just easy to be like, yeah, he's bad. Which, I was right about.
Right. So how did that embrace come to be of the philosophy of liberty for you?
Well, my big like origin moment was I happened to watch live in 2007,
yep,
one of the Republican primary debates. And I happened to just be the, you know, just coincidentally happened to be in front of the television for the Ron Paul, Rudy Giuliani moment. And I saw that and I was blown away. There was just something about Dr. Paul that was just so authentic and honest. It made so much sense. And it clicked for me that I was like, man, he is absolutely right. I was never a fan of Giuliani. He was he was the mayor in New York when I was a kid. And there were a lot of things about him I didn't like. And the Ron Paul, it just blew me away. And it was right away. I was like, who the hell is that guy? Mm-hmm. How have I never heard about this guy? And then I just was like, oh, I want to find out more about him. And I started going on YouTube, Google, you know, journeys to find out more. And slowly, he basically convinced me of the whole package.
Yeah, that was a big moment for me too. I mean, I think I had started to, you know, I came to this through school, right? Like, I was looking for a way to make school make sense. And finally, like, you know, what I've said on my show a bunch of times is, I had this collage of school problems, and when I started to understand like the principles of this philosophy, it turned it more into a mind map for me, for sure. And then, you know, the other issues kind of fell into place from there. And that's why I said I'm surprised that it's not more of a doorway for more people. Like, when I first heard Ron Paul, I was maybe like a year and a half into this investigation, and I was just thinking like, I can't believe that this guy's on TV. This can't last. And
right,
you know, by like a little context, like, before I found libertarianism by hunting around for new conspiracies to be into. So I was like a big 9/11 truther. So Giuliani was already like the most wicked person. He was wrapped up in all kinds of conspiracies. So when I saw that, I was like, yes, this is the guy. Like, I had been kind of flirting with that stuff for a while. But I think that for me, like it obviously was for so many people, where I really started to become passionate and want to advocate for this to other people, which went terribly for many years and burned lots of bridges. But sure, you had somewhat similar experiences in New York City.
Yeah. Well, I did. And there's something, you know, I've convinced way more people through my podcast, like people who I didn't know at all, than I have really people in my life. And I think maybe there's something to that, like a psychological dynamic there, where it's very hard for maybe friends or family members of yours who know you to give you that. Because then you are the one who like changed their whole worldview. And it's almost like they have to give you this credit or something like that.
Yeah.
Where someone who doesn't know you at all could be like, well, here's this guy, and I agree with his ideas, you know?
Yeah, especially if they're like a generation or two above you, And you're trying to convince them, like, I've seen you shit yourself and get excited about stuffed animals. Like, why the fuck would I listen to you? I just started to, like, mix it up with Free State people. And this one guy that I met in New Hampshire, he became my first webmaster. And I was talking to him about, like, all these frustrations of Sunday dinners and having these political arguments. So this would have been, like, 2009. And he said, man, you sure devote, to your point about the podcast, you sure devote a lot of energy and attention and emotion to seven people when there's thousands, tens of thousands of people out there who are ready to pay you money to hear you say this stuff, you know? So that actually was a really valuable reframing for me. Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons why the stakes are so high in those actual relationships. But obviously, all of the effective outreach I've done was with complete strangers, I would say. Yeah.
And no, I mean, there's really something interesting about that. And, you know, to what you were saying before, I've thought about this a bit lately. And actually, when I did that debate with Nick Sarwak, I mentioned this briefly. But, you know, the 9/11 truth, the truther movement, in many ways is almost what I think was the first kind of sign, or maybe in some ways the beginning of this whole tipping point that has resulted in, like, the Trump presidency and all of these, you know, crazy left-wing populist, right-wing populist, anti-establishment, anti-both parties, anti-media kind of world that we live in now. And, you know, the funny thing is I was never, like, really hardcore in the truther movement. I always flirted with it a little bit and would, like, watch videos and read stuff about it. But in so many ways, maybe not the craziest claims that the truthers made, but in so many ways, people who were suspicious of 9/11 have been vindicated. I mean, like, really vindicated. Like, there's, you know, it's basically come out that, yeah, the government lied to us about what happened. There's pretty much no question that there was major Saudi influence, that very high up level, you know, very high up people connected to the government in Saudi Arabia, who's our best friends over there, were basically involved in harboring the people who did the attack. Basically that all the subsequent wars were on the neocons hit list before then, that we know, you know, that we're willing to side with Al-Qaeda in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya. I mean, like, all of this stuff that basically vindicated them. Because I never could have imagined something like that in the 90s or the 80s, where there was this huge moment of people who would make such a, you know, such an audacious claim as, I think our government is complicit in the biggest terrorist attack on our country. Now, if you were to say something like that, I think almost both sides, left and right, would be like, I could see it, you know?
Oh, like, yeah, absolutely. I could see the president saying it. If it suited him, you know, in a certain situation. No, but he even talked years ago, because, like, the Saudi reference is those pages, like 28 pages that were redacted, and there were all kinds of revelations in there. Trump mentioned that a bunch of times early in his presidency. So whether that's a good thing, or, like, is that an encouraging thing or a concerning thing? I'm not sure, because obviously it's like we live in a culture of very elevated suspicion, right? And distrust. That is often a sign, I think, of the complete breakdown of a society, which has its own, you know, like, to channel Michael Malice for a minute, its own kind of excitement in watching a collapse. But it's also, you know, I know you as a new father, and, you know, anybody who's, like, trying to protect their family or what they have, it's a bit tense as well.
Yeah. No, it's scary. And that's definitely something that, you know, my perspective has changed quite a bit on that since having a child. Like, I'm not one of these, like, I'm rooting to burn the whole thing down to enjoy the show. I want, you know, whatever scenario is going to be the least violent is the one that I'd like to exist in. And that seems to be, you know, more and more in doubt that this is going to have a peaceful resolution. But it does seem like there's something there. Like, Murray Rothbard used to say that the essence of the libertarian populist argument is that these guys are ripping you off, like, you're getting ripped off. And I don't think that's ever been an easier sell than it is now.
No, and there's something very exciting about that. But I think also, I know you've talked about this too, like, in the last 3 or 4 years, I've seen a lot of the hope, the enthusiasm, and the optimism, certainly that I had, and I think I've watched this in other people too, in our movement, it's kind of vanished, right? It's kind of disappeared in distraction.
Oh, it's absolutely heartbreaking. I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but it's the most tragic thing that's ever happened in the history of the world. It's terrible. We had all the energy. We had everything on our side. It was, you know, in 2012, you know, I remember there was one point where Ron Paul was basically in a statistical tie for first place in Iowa and first place in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And we went, there is a real shot here that Ron Paul wins Iowa and New Hampshire. And if he wins both, the first caucus and the first primary, all of a sudden, the entire corporate press can't ignore him anymore. They right. can't. There's right. no way to get around that. They have to talk about the guy who won both of those. And then his ideas get a national hearing. And then everybody gets to see, all the people who didn't really pay attention get to see him. And guess what? We have all of the young intellectual energy on our side. There's no energy left in this neocon movement. This is all pre-Trump populist right. You know, so the only young energetic movement on the right was the Ron Paul Republicans. They were taking over the internet comment sections. They were taking over the delegate spots in the Republican Party. We were guaranteed the future. And guess what? Rand Paul just got into the Senate. So he's going to be the next Ron Paul. And this is the path there was. So, there was so much reason. It was coming off the heels of the Tea Party. And it was like, no, this is the real Tea Party here. You know, like this is the real mm-hmm. small government movement. And there was a lot of reason to be optimistic, and it all fell apart. And now we're not in a great place.
What do you attribute it to?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think Rand Paul. You know, I don't like to bash the guy because he's, you know, he's Ron Paul's son.
Like not picking up the torch.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, he's probably the greatest senator to ever live.
Sure.
But that's not good enough. You're Ron Paul's kid, and you had a mission. You had a mission in life, and he failed at it. And he decided that he had the worst calculation in like modern political history, which was that he was going to moderate his message in the year of the outsider, in the year where the obvious move was to embrace his father's legacy. And he rejected all of that. I mean, there was, you know, I'm not the first person to make this observation, but, you know, there's, you know, Jeb Bush's campaign bumper sticker was Jeb. And there's an obvious reason for that, right? Because he wasn't going to go with Bush because, right. you know, people kind of associate Bush with, you know, two disastrous wars, you know, the lies and, you know, the Katrina and the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, you know, not such great stuff. So he went Jeb, but there was no reason for Rand Paul's slogan to be Rand. And he right. went with that for a reason too. His campaign slogan should have been Paul. I'm picking up on where my father left off. And instead, he was criticizing Donald Trump for not pledging to support the Republican nominee, no matter who they were, and just these and trying to suck up to like big neocon donors and stuff like that. And he lost all the support. It all went to Trump because he seemed like the real outsider. And also on top of that, you know, Donald Trump was also able to speak to some issues that libertarians haven't dealt with very well. And part of that is that, you know, a lot of people don't really care about philosophy or economics or any of that stuff, but they definitely know that the media has been lecturing them for being white for the last 5 years.
Sure.
And they're kind of like, I'd like to not feel terrible about myself because of some immutable characteristic. And you know what? I don't like that the demographics of the country are changing in a way that I never, you know, was asked. And fuck the media, something libertarians were never really going to say. Like, how about that? How about a big middle finger to all these people? And we never had anyone really deliver that message in anything that was satisfying like that. There's something about a more naked populism without a philosophical underpinning that is more attractive to a large group of people. You don't really need all that stuff that most people aren't interested in anyway.
It's easier to understand. And it's not that people can't understand more complicated things. It's like they have a limited amount of time to try to understand these things. Trump was perfectly calculated in a message that was very accessible. I think everybody knew. I think even the libertarians who went the way of build that wall knew there was never going to be a wall, you know, that the wall was something tangible. That you could give people that it said something. It didn't need to ever be built, right? It's just like, I could tell you a really smart story about how to fix our immigration problem if I thought you would like it and if I thought it would resonate with you. Instead, I'm going to use this four-letter word. And that turned out to be much more successful. So, Dave, the way you answered that question, do you really think that like a wider spread embrace of these ideas hinges on the political? Because like I'm at a point now where I would say, you know, like the mission of my site is achieving individual liberty through self-education, self-knowledge, and self-improvement, right? And how to, you know, follow the Harry Brown idea of living freely in an unfree world. And I don't have much hope for anything on a larger scale. But do you still have it? And do you think that that's the avenue to achieve it?
Well, I'd say this, right? So, I mean, obviously, like, I agree with you, and I'm doing a similar thing, right?
Right.
So I also try to live that way and try to encourage other people to, and try to just introduce these ideas to other people on a more, you know, non-political level.
Sure.
But I just think there's two things that almost need to be separated out. So I do not believe in political solutions being very likely, maybe not completely impossible, but I don't think, like, things were going to get better if we elected Ron Paul, because then he was going to roll back the state. I mean, even as you've seen with Donald Trump, there's, you know, look at the amount of you know, stuff he's had to deal with from, you know, the CIA and the FBI and the NSA, the corporate press, the Democratic and Republican establishments. Imagine someone like Ron Paul, like a real threat to power.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he might be taking a convertible ride through Dallas. You know what I mean? Like, he's,
yeah.
They would have really come after that guy. So I'm not saying political solutions. However, also look at what Ron Paul was able to do by utilizing the political process to spread ideas. And I think that is incredibly powerful. So to me, the only real hope is to, you know, awaken to some degree as much of the remnant as possible, to convince as many people, you know, that to believe in liberty, in if at least in some general sense, be anti-war in some general sense, anti-state in some general sense, the best you can hope for. I do think that Rand Paul, okay, then this is why I talk about the Rand Paul campaign. Rand Paul's first moment on the debate, which is the one thing that like most people do watch, are these debates.
Yeah.
Not most people, but a lot of people, tens of millions of people watch them. His first moment was the first time he spoke, they asked the question, this was a question to everybody, raise your hand, but it was a question, wink, wink, to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They said, will you agree that you will support the nominee no matter who that person is? Which was, hey, Donald Trump, you're leading in the polls now, but we all know you can't win and you're not going to win this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So will you agree to support Jeb Bush when we all decide that he's the nominee? And everyone except Donald Trump raised their hand. And Donald Trump said, I'll have to see who the nominee is. And then Rand Paul interrupted and said, look, this guy won't even pledge to support the nominee, no matter who he is. He's not a real Republican. And to me, that was the moment the Rand Paul campaign was over, never to get any life again. I mean, the idea that the role of Rand Paul was to say,
right,
hey,
yeah,
if Lindsey Graham wins, then you got to support Lindsey Graham, because that's what a good Republican does. I mean, this was just bonkers. And I remember, you know, me and Scott Horton have had conversations about this before, but it's like, just play the counterfactual in your head of what if Rand Paul had been Ron Paul? What if Rand Paul had stood up there and said, look, first off, I would never support Lindsey Graham for president. And by the way, there's only two people on this stage who have a shot at this nomination. It's me and Donald Trump. You think America's going to elect another Bush again after mm-hmm. the disaster of the last one? This election is about who can, you know, actually drain the swamp. Now, Trump may claim he's an outsider, but he's a billionaire from New York who is donating money to the Clintons. I'm Ron Paul's son. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to end every last one of these wars. We're abolishing the Federal Reserve. We're going to release nonviolent prisoners from prison. We're going to end the war on drugs. We're going to yada, yada, yada. You know, all the like hardcore, I'm the outsider. I'm convinced there would still be a thriving libertarian movement if he had done that. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. So all that being said, this is the last stop down this path, and then we'll follow the breadcrumbs back out to my two-question outline. And believe me, this is absolutely great that we went down this path. But all of that being said, I know that you have like a reinvigorated interest right now in the Libertarian Political Party, right? I would want to know what you think can be achieved through that, when the only model that's proven successful in this century for these ideas has been to have a guy who is a libertarian run as a Republican. Libertarians debate each other in something that shows up on YouTube, but it doesn't seem like it has much more reach than that. So what's your interest or your hopes for the party right now?
Well, okay, so I basically agreed with Ron Paul in 2008, 2012. People used to ask him all the time why he's not running on the Libertarian Party, why he's running as a Republican. And he would just say, well, all the rules are kind of stacked against against third parties. And I've been a Republican and it's just easier to use this party. And I was like, yeah, that's it. And look at Donald Trump. I mean, he was basically a third party candidate who won just using the Republican Party. So right. I was like, yeah, the Libertarian Party is irrelevant. It wasn't until after Rand Paul's campaign collapsed and Donald Trump won the nomination that I started to revisit the idea of the Libertarian Party. And I did see the amount of attention and the spotlight that Gary Johnson and Bill Weld got. And like it or not, the situation in 2016 was you had the two most hated candidates, these two clearly corrupt, lying, you know, borderline sociopathic candidates. And then you had a third party with ballot access in all 50 states that bore the name Libertarian.
This is a very tragic story that you're telling.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. And what did we do with it? What did we do with it? We put up, you know, this just horrendous ticket. There was something in me that I was like, man, there was a real opportunity there. Like if there had been a real Libertarian there, maybe they could have reached some more people. And so it got me a little more interested in the idea of the LP. And then like Michael Heiss and the LP Mises Caucus guys came in and I was like, all right, well, there's some good people here who want to do something. So I joined just to be like, hey, I'll support these guys, throw my support behind them. But my only interest was really in finding a national candidate who was really a true radical in the best sense of the word, who really understood the philosophy and if given an opportunity could maybe convince some more people to get on board with this. And I really think Jacob Hornberger is the best I could have hoped for. And, you know, I just hope he can, you know, I think he's going to win the nomination. He's got a lot of energy behind him right now. And I just think it's a great tool potentially to be able to spread these ideas. Like sometimes I think people like me and you can forget that there's still so many people who have just never come in contact with these ideas that are, you know, convertible.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's going to be another opportunity, which is one of the reasons why, you know, I'm willing to talk about this. In 2020, why did CNN in 2016, let's just go back to that for a second, do like a big forum town hall with libertarians? Because they care about libertarian ideas? No, it was to take votes away from Trump. So that same thing is possible again this year. And yeah, I mean, the two major parties in 2016 said, look, we're going to show you the two grossest people you've ever seen, and you can pick one. And you're absolutely right. It was the biggest missed opportunity. I would say that was more tragic than 2012. That was such an enormous missed opportunity to have somebody. And like to just like know which way the wind was blowing and what the public wanted, right? Like controversial, divisive, sensational type figures.
All of that. But in addition to that, to call out the center, like that was the whole point, is that it was anti-establishment.
Yeah. Right.
You know, not to go, oh, we represent the establishment, let's bring it back. This is getting crazy. It's like, no, the fact is that people woke up, whether, you know, maybe they didn't have the perfect underlying philosophy, but people woke up to the idea that this whole thing is a ripoff. This is all a big con job. I mean, it's obvious. It's obvious to anyone that we can no longer do anything as a, you know, politically, as a society. I mean, we can't win our wars. We can't balance our budgets. We can't protect our borders. We can't, like, there's nothing. And this is really basic and obvious to everyone. And of course, we live in this world. We live in the post 2008 financial recession,
right? Yeah,
where every libertarian knows the deal with this stuff. This is a completely phony recovery. This is what type of recovery do you get from lowering interest rates to zero and record high government spending? Hey, you can show me some numbers on a board. You can look at the stock market and say it came back up, but where did all the new wealth go? It went to the Wall Street casinos and it went to the politically connected. Why do you think the Rust Belt was furious? You know, yeah. I mean, it's so to come out and go, man, this guy, Donald Trump, is really offensive. That's the libertarian message. I mean, it was a guaranteed failure.
Absolutely. So, Dave, for the sake of time, sharp transition coming up right here.
Sure.
So my vision for the show today was to give you a forum to do your own version of Rothbard's Education Free and Compulsory, which I'm sure you've read, right? Mm-hmm. So to talk about the compulsory, your experience, and then the question I'd really like to ask you, what would you envision education looking like in a voluntary society? But the second version of that question, because we might not live in such a world at the time when your daughter's education begins and you might need a backup plan, how do you plan to educate a free and happy person in an unfree and often unhappy world? And if you could start, because I'd really like to hear the answer to the first question, if there were no obstacles, what does education look like in a voluntary society?
Well, I would just start by saying that I think that the model that we're using is so ass backward. And it's, and of course, I mean, you've done more work, like I've learned from you, you know, about like where the real roots, where the real, you know, Prussian pre-Nazi roots of all of this stuff comes mm-hmm. from. But it's obviously, it's the whole system is made to create obedient servants to the state. I mean, you know, it's these things that people don't even think about. I know it's, you know, silly for me to be telling you this, but, you know, pledging allegiance to the state is like how this thing begins before you sit in a row of desks and memorize and regurgitate. But when you have a state, there is an incentive to have good subjects. That's where this is one of the worst parts of having a state is that all of the incentives get completely, you know, out of whack. So, of course, they've got an incentive to have people who are willing to go to war for them, who are willing to pay their taxes, who are willing to follow their rules. And that's where the incentives come from. If you had a voluntary society or anything approaching it, all of the incentives are to have, you know, productive members of society, creative members of society, people who produce and make the world a better place to live in. So, look, children, as anybody who's spent any time around young kids knows, they are naturally unbelievably interested in the world and unbelievably excited about participating in the adult world.
Absolutely.
This is why little kids all, you know, you spend some time with like a 3 or a 4 year old. All they do is they ask you a bunch of, you know, to the point of it being annoying, just questions about the world. Why does this happen? What does this mean?
Absolutely.
What's that?
Yep.
You know, they just want to know. They have this very natural desire to know. And then they love participating in adult activity. That even when you have to like do it, you know, you have to humor them or kind of, you know, in some mock way, like they want to sit with their mother while she's baking and like add one ingredient. And then when the brownies come out, go, I helped make these. They
so,
love it.
Yes, absolutely true. I mean, I was in New Hampshire this summer and my nephew, he was like 9 years old and just, you know, acting out for attention, that kind of thing. Like just to get some visibility. And I said, you know, you want to help make hamburgers and be the guy who made the hamburgers. And it was like winning the lottery for him. Yeah. Man, kids just want meaning and self-efficacy, and they're just dying like from a very early age to find an outlet
right.
for that.
So,
yeah.
So the role of education, once you understand that, it's like, well, it's clear. It's to nurture that and encourage all of that. Well, guess what? How exciting is this? You get to know a whole lot of stuff, and you get to participate in the adult world. And the model we have right now is the exact opposite. It's like get in a row of desks, memorize, and regurgitate. And don't speak out of turn and don't be, you know, in any way an individual, don't stray from the group. So I don't know exactly what the model is. I mean, I know that me and you are having a conversation, you know, over our computers right now, and that pretty much every great thinker who's ever lived is accessible to on the screen right in front of us. I think, you know, probably people who specialize in this and are smarter than me can figure out, you know, like what, or try different methods. But just like anything else, I think you would have laboratories of innovation, lots of people trying different things, and different methods would rise up as being more successful than others. But the base of it is to encourage that the most beautiful natural human desire, instead of squashing it, which is the current model.
Mm. You know, we mentioned the history as contrasting to what we'd like to see. And I was just going through my notes for some other reason the other day, and I found this quote. I know you've talked about Horace Mann, right?
Mm-hmm.
The father of American public education. And I found this quote in my notes from his 7th annual report. So for people who don't know the story, Mann and a bunch of other guys, and this wasn't just the United States, Great Britain did this, France did this. They would go and they would look at the education systems or the schooling systems, more appropriately, in Central Europe in the middle of the 1800s. And one of the reasons why they were doing it is they viewed the states there as industrial competitors and they wanted to see what they were doing, right? So Mann would go and he would issue these reports. Mann never saw the schools operate. He only talked to principals. He didn't even talk to teachers or students. So he toured empty buildings and he talked to administrators, the people who were most disconnected from the day-to-day school experience. And he would issue these reports. And, you know, he brought it back to the state of Massachusetts. And that's where it was adopted. And from there, it spread like wildfire because people understood its power. So in this seventh annual report, I found this as a screenshot. And I was like, holy shit. If like the entire 20th century of public education in the United States had a movie trailer, it's this quote. The question is sometimes asked, why, with such a wide, extended, and energetic machinery for public education, the Prussians, as a people, do not rise more rapidly in the scale of civilization? Why the mechanical and useful arts remain among them in such a half-barbarous condition? Why the people are so sluggish and unenterprising in their character? And finally, why certain national vices are not yet extirpated. Now, this is an observation that a man is making, I would guess, in the late 1840s, when this system has existed for two generations. And basically what he's saying is, why, if they have these schools, do they suck so bad, these people? This is his answer. It's just such a snapshot of government and really like of the schools. These questions may be readily answered. First, it is a great defect of the people's schools of Prussia that the children leave them at so early an age.
Hmm.
Right? Man, when all you have is a hammer, you know?
Yeah.
You look at any kind of bureaucracy that is only able to, because there is no innovation, there is no creativity, and they're only able to do one thing. If that thing that they do does not work, it means we're not doing enough of it and we're not doing it hard enough, right?
Yeah.
And that's
yeah,
what the American people got.
Yeah, and right, it's when you only have a hammer and when you start from a faulty a priori that this is a good. So this is a good, but it's not working out well. Well, then we must need more of this good. I mean, right? Like we must need to spend more money. We must need to keep them longer. We must need to do this. If you're unable to question whether this is actually counterproductive to begin with, you're going to go to some really bad places.
So because we only have a few minutes left, I did want to get to the question because your daughter is going to grow up in a world probably very similar to the one we live in now. What thought have you put into her education?
Well, quite a bit. But I think to answer that question, I'd have to just stress, you know, the what I think might be maybe the core message of your show, which is the difference between education and school.
Mm-hmm.
And that they really are not one and the same. And one of the biggest tricks ever has been to think of school as education and education as school. I'm very hesitant, you know, to send my daughter to one of these crazy schools. And me and my wife have discussed, you know, several different options and homeschooling and things like that. But we're still doing a lot of research and like looking into it. My daughter's only 1 year old, so
right.
We have a little bit of time before that. But truthfully, I mean, like I live in one of the things, and we could rail against the public school system and state-run schools all day, and they, you know, fairly so. That's a huge, huge problem. But I live in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I got to say, one of the things that really just disturbs me the most is not, it's just the culture amongst people that this, you know, of all the transitions that America made, and libertarians talk about a lot of them, a lot of the big transitions, you know, from going from a republic to an empire, going from the gold standard to a fiat currency, or, you know, like whatever, from not having an income tax to having an income tax, you know, the National Security Act or any of these huge transitions. But one of the most profound, probably more profound than any of that stuff, is that we became a society where parents don't raise their children.
Oh,
and this
yeah.
almost never gets discussed or brought up. It's just kind of like a way of life. It's like, oh yeah, we don't raise our kids anymore. And I just, as a new parent, I'm like perplexed by this. I can't believe that so many people are willing to accept the idea that they don't raise their children. And I live in like a real nice neighborhood with like wealthy people around and stuff. And they all accept it. It's like all like nannies and daycare and like you're working two jobs and you're making like the, you know, $300,000 a year as a family income. And yet you're still, you wouldn't rather make 150 and raise your kids?
Oh, absolutely.
And it's the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. So one thing, I mean, that me and my wife have made a really strong commitment about is like that we're going to raise our daughter. We're not outsourcing that to anyone else. And we will be involved in the education process of her life all the way through. And to me, it's like, you know, I don't know what we'll end up, you know, going with finally, like if we'll homeschool her or send her to private school or what, but I know that. And to me, I think that's like the most important thing.
That's such a good point. And it was really an important lesson for me in my career as an educator from like the years to when my career started for like the first 5 or 6 years, I worked with kids in a boarding school. So they came from the not so nice parts of New York, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., to this little residence in Vermont, or it was actually a big residence. It had like several campuses. These were kids whose their parents were drug addicts. They had been abandoned. They had been neglected. And that was a really sad environment to be in. And when I left there, I moved to the greater Boston area, which is very wealthy. And I worked in the suburbs as a tutor and a college consultant. These were people who lived in $500,000 houses at least. Dad was a lawyer. Mom worked too in every single case. And the raising of their children, I was one of the people that it was outsourced to. And it felt like being with these kids, it almost felt like the same kind of abandonment existed, except their parents were just there to abandon them to me.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, the same problems across two very different types of populations.
And the one on in the upper class is almost more disturbing because it's like done by choice.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to do this.
There's no desperation. Yeah.
Choosing. It's like, I'm telling you, here on the Upper West Side where I live, it's like so many of these families where it's like they live in like multi-million dollar homes. They summer in the Hamptons. You know what I mean? Like they have all of these, there's so many things that you could easily cut a few of these out of your life or downsize. And the cost of this is you not raising your children. And it's amazing to me that this transition from a country where parents raise their children to a country where they don't is never even widely discussed. It's just like, oh, well, this is the direction that we went.
Geez, how do we not end on such a low note? Give me something optimistic.
Yeah, this kind of has had a an undertone of tragedy throughout the whole thing. Well, look, man, I mean, there is a lot to be optimistic about in the world. And the fact that, you know, conversations like this are happening, the fact that people really are more and more so getting educated from non-state school means, like the fact that people are learning so much on the internet, and there is, you know, for all the garbage that's out on the internet, there's a lot of really powerful, great stuff. And the best thing that's happening right now is that people are on a large level seeing through the establishment, seeing through the ruling class. You just can't convince people anymore that this is all, you know, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden have their best interest at heart. They know better than that. And there's a reason why, like, you know, stuff like the Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself memes are going so viral.
Far and wide, yeah.
People see through this. It's like, no, we know what's going on. We know, you know, it's really, somebody tweeted, I thought this was so funny, it really stuck with me, but they go, it turns out that Pizzagate aged better than Russian collusion.
Yep.
Like, if you look back at the two of them, like it actually, like, all right, maybe Pizzagate wasn't exactly right, but there really was something to that. Like, oh, wow, there's really like a whole bunch of pedophiles who hang out with these, you know, like really powerful elites. It does seem to me that it's, and this is what they're figuring out right now with Joe Biden, that it might be impossible for them to run these 30-year career politicians and still convince anybody that these people are not corrupt. And there's something really, really positive about that. We'll see where it goes, but there's something positive there.
Yeah, and we should be able to tolerate some growing pains of that kind of wake up, right? It's probably going to go through an ugly, awkward phase, and we're in it now, but I think it's generally something to be excited about. Look how we turned that around and went out on a positive note. Yeah. Wonderful.
Look at that. Beautiful.
I got one more for you. So I was going to have you plug your stuff at the end of the show. Obviously, you do the Legion of Skanks podcast with Luis J. Gomez and Jay Okerson. Your show is Part of the Problem. And I will tell you, it served as a bridge, Part of the Problem did, to bring the most wonderful person I've ever met into my life. She listened to your show. She found your show to be influential and transformative, and it was something that we bonded over very early on. And she told me about this, and she said, "Do you know Dave Smith?" I said, "No, but I replaced him on a ship one time. I took his spot on the Contra cruise when he couldn't go. So thank you for existing, because otherwise that might never have happened." And there's no way I could be happier that it did.
That legitimately warms my heart. I'm very happy to hear that.
Her name is Jordan.
All right. Shout out to Jordan.
Dave, thank you so much for doing this. I hope we can do it again sometime in the future. Really enjoyable conversation.
Absolutely, man. 100%. Let me know. I'd love to do it again.
Awesome.
That was a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Later, brother.